to The Civic Flame, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the U.S. Constitution and civics education. I am your host, Dr. Amber Veo, adjunct professor of law and policy. I'm excited to announce that I have returned my book, Birthzillas and Betrayal, to the publisher and will be able to share more about that with you soon. For more on that, take a look at my other podcast, Birthzillas. My next book will go much more in line with this podcast and will explore the state of civic relationships in the United States. This week, we are, as you might expect, thinking about the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Among the things we're doing to get ready for the 250th anniversary is planning a road trip to the Midwest. We're going to hit St. Louis, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Indianapolis, and Springfield, Illinois for the return of the Women's Professional Baseball League. I will be in the stands on August 2nd cheering for Boston, and I am very excited about it. So if we have any listeners out there with recommendations for us for where to go or what to do, definitely let me know. I've got two kids and they are excited about being on a road trip because they've never been on one before. I imagine about 4.5 hours into the car, it's going to be anarchy in the back seat. But we also want to talk about the Declaration of Independence itself. So grab your birthday party hats and let's go. There are a lot of places you can go to learn about the Declaration of Independence. Some of my favorites are the National Archives, either in person or online, the National Constitution Center, and the Bill of Rights Center. These are all great resources that offer an interesting history of the document itself, conversations about how it was created, and if you go to the National Archives, you even get to see it. Most recently, I've been reading the children's book, The Journey of the One and Only Declaration of Independence by Judith St. George, because yes, I am that kind of nerd, and double yes, you can pity my children. So as King George III and Parliament were tightening their grip around the colonies, the colonists were starting to get angrier and angrier. Things like the Stamp Act in 1765, which tried to mandate anything printed on paper be stamped by the crown and was largely seen as a money grab for the crown, the Boston Massacre in 1770, which in true Boston fashion began as a street brawl, the Boston Tea Party in 1773, you know, we just get upset about stuff, and other key events were creating a lot of trouble for the 13 colonies. If today you are in Boston, you can go to the Abigail Tea House and the Boston Tea Party ship and throw some tea over the harbor just for funsies. But eventually, back in the 1700s, people like Sam Adams, yes, the beer guy, Patrick Henry of Virginia, Thomas Paine, and some of the more famous folks you've heard of if you watched Hamilton, started thinking that so-called Mad King George, an ocean away, might not be the best person to govern them. While there is an argument to be made that your average, non-wealthy colonist was better off under British rule, it didn't seem like that to a lot of those swearing obedience to the crown, but being recognized as second-class citizens. Hence the no taxation without representation motto. Plus, let's be real, when you take all of your society's malcontents, whether that is for religious, financial, or other reasons, stick them on boats, and send them off to make a few colonies together, sooner or later that discontented spirit is going to break out. And boy, did it. But you can't just start a revolution against the biggest military in the world. If you want to win a war, you need bodies, boots, bullets, band-aids, and buddies. For us, that meant money and allies. The Declaration of Independence was not just about declaring our independence. It was about convincing colonists to become Americans. People to put their lives and money on the line, and getting people around the world, especially France, to be on our side. The first people you have to convince are always your own people. Because while we call it a revolution today, then it was a civil war. Americans have been largely protected from war within our borders. So I think we forget what we're asking people, all people, to deal with in a war zone. It's not just about getting soldiers to boot up and fight, but of course that is part of it. In a civil war, you are asking everyone to be willing to suffer deprivations of some kind, whether that is a lack of heat in the winter, lack of food, physical, sexual, psychological violence, all of it. And that's a pretty hard sell to most people. So the Declaration of Independence stands as a key piece of persuasive writing because the first people it needs to persuade are its own. Let's look at the document itself and see what got the colonists so ready to rumble. In Congress, July 4th, 1776, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. See, that's nice. Basic, justified what it's doing. This paragraph is meant to make you understand that we're not just going off half-cocked. We have some good causes. Next, we want you to understand what we think the purpose of government is. This is the big deal. This is the philosophical foundations, or at least supposed to be the philosophical foundations, of what would become not only the United States, but modern ideologies about popular sovereignty, representative government, and anti-monarchist sentiments globally. So the next paragraph goes, and it's probably the one you're most familiar with, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as seem to them most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such a government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world." Obviously, there was some hypocrisy here. Black people were still enslaved in a lot of areas. Women did not have equal rights under the law or in society. Indigenous folks were being stripped of their lands. They were being murdered. They were being bereft of their entire culture. And anyone who didn't own property had fewer rights than people who did own property. But it is an aspirational document, and it is something to which we still aspire, however imperfectly. Well, next, our boys present their evidence. Let's look at what our forefathers thought were compelling reasons to rebel against a tyrannical leader. And maybe on this 250th anniversary, you can print yourself out a little bingo game and think of all the things in the last 250 years that we kind of let slide that would have launched a revolution in the 1700s. Here's our list. He has refused his assent to the most wholesome and necessary laws for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise. The state, remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary power. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount of payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us, in many cases, of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond the seas to be tried for pretend offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and a fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government. For suspending our own legislators and declaring them invested with powers to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrection among us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. nor have we been wanting in attention to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them, by the ties of our common kindred, to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondences. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind. Enemies in war, in peace, friends. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract allies, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do, and for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Those who drafted and signed the Declaration of Independence may have been a little wide-eyed optimistic, but many were also people who had already served in war, so they knew some of what they were asking their countrymen and women to endure. It is important to think about how big and earth-shattering this felt at the time. Not only were we launching a civil war, but we were flat out saying that the purpose of a government should be to secure the rights of the people, that we have a liberty interest against tyranny. And this was a pretty big deal at a time when quite a large chunk of the world was not only overseen by monarchies, but often by the same small group of monarchies. And so when we think about the radicalism of the Declaration of Independence, and honestly, as I've talked about in this podcast, the radicalism of the United States Constitution, it's sometimes disappointing to see how these documents are used against radical populist agendas. And I don't mean populist in the bad majority rule, minority gets overrun way, but I mean the actual representative of democracy, putting people at the center of your policies, putting people at the center of your platforms, putting people at the center of your country, because that's what these documents, you know, intended to do. Obviously, they weren't perfect at the time, for sure, right? There was the joke in England about how Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence with one hand and held the slave master's whip in the other hand. There were certainly imperfect allies at best, to be generous. You know, their characterization of Native Americans as savage, the idea that the wars Native Americans and indigenous people waged against colonists were any more brutal than what colonists had done to them is certainly a fiction that I think kept a lot of people's mental state intact or destroyed, depending on who you were. But it's an imperfect document for an imperfect nation. It's an aspirational document for an aspirational nation. It's a revolutionary document for what should be a revolutionary nation. And so I think as we look at our 250th anniversary, it's really a good idea to consider Lincoln and recommit to this government of the people, by the people, and for the people, to say this government will not perish from this earth, not by saying we love the government, but by saying the idea that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, that's what should not perish from this earth. This centrality of sovereignty being people's sovereignty, right? And so I think it's something to consider as we go through to celebrating our birthday parties. One of the things that I am doing for our 250th party is asking people to bring their most ridiculous 250th branded content. At the moment, I have a bag of chips with a wise owl dressed as George Washington. I will put that on Instagram. And if you have anything better that is the craziest 250th anniversary branded content, definitely share that with Mother of Democracy on Instagram because I want to see it. I can't give you anything if you win except, you know, respect. Well, that was a lot, but this is a big birthday. After 250 years, it is important to take stock of where we are as a nation, whether we have lived up to our highest ideals, and how we can continue to further those ideals for ourselves and our posterity. Americans have often been hesitant to admit that democracy and representative government are incredibly fragile things. For all of the ways the U.S. is exceptional, we are also just as vulnerable as everyone else, and in some ways more so, to losing our democracy. Democracy requires constant vigilance, because those who seek to subvert democracy only have to get lucky once. They only have to get their foot in the door. And those of us who wish to protect democracy have to guard it all the time, have to navigate difficult understandings of what democracy is, and have to work with each other in ways that we might not always love. Perhaps it's my age or where and when I was raised, but my faith in the United States, in the people of the United States, is absolute. I believe that as difficult a situation as we are in now, we can come back better for these challenging times. I had hoped that our 50th anniversary would be something I could just happily revel in and celebrate. But we are at a crisis point in ways we haven't been since the Civil War, and even the Revolution itself. Some people suggest we need a new Declaration of Independence and a new Constitution, or new Americas. But I believe we already have what we need to succeed. We just have to remember who we are. And I believe that we are good, that we love our neighbors, that we love each other, that we may fight, but that at the end of the day, we all value something bigger than ourselves. So to all of you out there on this 4th of July, whether you think I am a pie-eyed, naive Pollyanna optimist, or you just think I am a crazy cynic lady, keep the civic flame burning bright and take care out there. The Civic Flame is a Mother of Democracy production with writer Amber Veo and sound manager Matthew Munyon. Thanks for listening.